You know, one of the big things in my life, being that I'm not one of the smartest guys in school. Does anyone know anything about FXCM, by the way? A little bit? Yeah. Where do you trade?
Now I don't trade. I own a kosher restaurant.
It's a lot less risky.
I don't know, every day you come in, you got Lehman Brothers, Bank of American Laundry.
They both traded dough.
FXCM, I guess I'm just going to start from that and then we'll work our way into how it became into existence. Right now, it's probably the biggest online foreign exchange firm in the world. And it has offices in New York, in Dallas, in San Francisco, my pride and joy in Israel. It has an office there, in Hong Kong and in London, opening up in Dubai, and Shenzhen, China. And a few more offices to open. It started in 1999, and in a room probably a quarter of the size of this room, and really started out with a bunch of people with not a lot of money, so we have a lot more partners because people really couldn't afford to pay anybody to work. So if you wanted to work at the firm, you joined the firm as a partner. And it grew from around six partners in 1999 to the offices I mentioned, around 500 employees. And right now, thankfully, and thank God, has earnings that are over $100 million of net profit. And I'm not saying that to boast. I'm saying that so we have an ideal and a perspective of what it takes to schedule having 500 employees, these types of offices, and these types of earnings, and the type of risk that I'm sure you're aware of, and I'm sure you're also aware of, and trading foreign currency, and having people trade through FXCM foreign currency, and that's what we do. We offer the ability for customers all over the world through the internet to look at the different prices in the different foreign currencies, open up an account, and trade with the hopes of making money, or sometimes hedging certain types of risk that they have throughout the world if they're actually... they have a business in Europe where they have receivables that they get from a foreign country and they want to make sure that their receivables are going to be worth X amount. They'll actually place a trade to make sure to hedge that risk that they have that the foreign currency might fluctuate. That's FXCM. The way it, you know, getting back to myself a little bit on how it started is I never believed that I would be a part of owning a company or ever smart enough to actually own a company. I was never the brightest student by far. And I remember being in college and hearing a professor of mine, it was an economics class and it was around 150 people, and he came in and said, I have some good news and I have some bad news. The good news is that half the class got an A on their midterm, and the bad news is the other half got C or below. But you should know, the really good news is all those C students, you should really look out at all those A students, they'll work for you one day. And I said, hey, I have a chance of making it. That's the sense that you never know. So I realized it's not up to my intelligence to go ahead and try and make a living. It's really up to fate and up to, you know, certain things that fall into place. And when I was going through law school and I was trying to decide what to do, because I didn't think law school was 100% for me, L.A. Law was a great show on TV, but I realized that it's not what law is all cracked up to be. So I was working during the day at a firm called BCMG, which was also foreign currency. I knew nothing about it from college. Just, that's where I got an accounting job, and I learned a lot about foreign currency. And I met a friend of mine. At that time, he was an associate. And he was sick for a while, but he came back from his leave of absence. And I asked him, he's the only other Jew in the office, and I said, you know, before going to law school, maybe it would be a great idea if we just learned for a half an hour together. And he said, you know, it's a great idea. And we learned. And we were both getting into it. We enjoyed learning with one another. And I remember that at one day, there was a trader, and his wife decided for his birthday that she was going to hire a stripper that should show up to the office. I was downstairs, and he was upstairs. And everyone said, oh, you know, Ken, let's go. Let's go upstairs, you know. Hey, it's a great birthday present for everybody. So I said, I think I'd rather not. I think lay downstairs. I figured, you know, everyone's free time now, so I opened up my safer, and in came my friend, William, and he says, you know what, I think I'll join you in that learning. And I remember that he left the firm, and at that point, probably the best thing happened to me in my financial career is that the company decided to merge, and I lost my job. That was by far the best thing that ever happened. And William came to me and said, I have this great idea. I have a wonderful, wonderful idea. Let's open up a firm that we can introduce to a retail customer the ability to trade foreign currency. Because in 1999, only banks were able to really trade with other banks, or very high net worth or people could trade foreign currency. Because the banks would just rip people off. They wouldn't know where the market was. There was no transparency in the market. There was nothing out there. So we figured this is a great thing to get into, to try and introduce the ability to trade foreign currency with just the same type of customer that are trading stocks, with less manipulation, as we see today. So he said, you know what, I trust you. We were learning together for around a year. Why don't we open up this firm? And I had no other choice because I had no source of earning an income at that point. And I was trying to actually find a job, but it wasn't easy. And I remember my wife telling me, you know, this guy William, he gives a lot of charity. You should stick with him. I'm telling you, he's going to go somewhere. So my wife, she worked in a factory, and she wanted to go to school, but she delayed going to school. So we'd be able to put some food on the table and be able to diaper the two kids that we had. So at that time, William and I opened up the firm, and at that same exact time, a big venture capital firm and a big name firm named Gain Capital, same idea, great-looking website, and we thought for sure we're dead. But in the end, I think the fact that there wasn't greed involved and we were willing to pay people to introduce customers to us, at times more than what we were even willing to make, which was something that my competitor did not want to do. How can I pay somebody more that he'll end up making more than me? You still make something. But William and I said to one another, you know what? It's better to have 10% of a big number than 100% of nothing. And a lot of those customers, people that wanted to introduce, hey, they were happy making a lot more money, and they introduced their customers to us. And through that, we ended up beating out a firm that was funded at that time with $10 million, and our firm was probably funded with $50,000 of cash and a $500,000 home equity line, which we probably put on the line to have credit with the banks. And I promised myself that as I was becoming more religious, that if the firm would take off, that I would devote a lot more of my time to religious studies, because I found that having those religious studies helped me make so many important decisions in my life. It also helped. I don't think anyone can even be a good trader unless they have a certain amount of discipline, they have a certain kind of emotion. If you don't have that discipline to know when to, a lot of traders, they're willing to hold on to all their losses, but for some reason, the second they have a little bit of gain, they're out. So why would somebody want to hold on to losses so far down and yet only hold on to such little gains? Because people get emotional, they get attached to their trade, they don't want to accept that they may have lost. And instead, they'll just hold the losses and hold the losses until a lot of customers, unfortunately, lose everything. And then there are certain types of customers that, no, they're not going to hold a loss any more than they'll hold a gain. And a lot of those traders are a lot more successful at the firm. And I felt, but how do you become that way? How do you become disciplined? How do you become a certain amount of emotion or willing to accept certain losses in life? And I felt that the more I studied, the more I was able to have that realization and have that emotional attachment more to religion than to actually making the money, which actually helped me make more money. So I made a promise that if I'm going to make a certain amount of money, I'm going to devote more time to learning. And there were times in my life that I was able to see that having that dedication only helped me and didn't hurt me. I remember when I lost my job at that firm, BCMG, and I was always taught that you always have to give charity. Even if I wasn't so religious, you always, if you're making money, you have to give back 10%. So I just lost my job, and it was a very nice paying job. And now there was no prospect of, at least right now, because the firm at the beginning was not making money, that I was going to actually make any more money, it was other than the unemployment check. So I decided, you know what, I'm not going to stop giving the money. So I gave the 10%, and I remember 3 weeks later, there was this penny stock I owned. I can't even tell you the symbol, it was ADGI. And it did nothing for 2 years that I owned this stock. And literally 3 weeks later, I got back, I thought it would be a great story if I got the exact amount of money that I gave to Tzedakah back, but that didn't happen until I realized when I gave 10% of the money that I made on the stock, that was the exact amount of money that I gave. And I made it right back. And I said, you know what? That's my sign. You do the right thing. And I'm not blind to the fact that there are many people that try and do the right thing, and it doesn't always appear to be that it's always the best thing. But I think if we look into it and we realize that it doesn't always sometimes appear to be the right thing or the best thing, I should say. But in the end, all these things help me grow and help me to the realization that in the end, the net result, it's not how much money, it's not how successful, it's really how happy you are. And doing all of this, and going to study and having that relationship with the yeshiva or with my learning, really just makes me a happier person, because I know so many people that really are very, very wealthy and are so unhappy. But having that relationship with the yeshiva makes it that that's not the only important thing in life, is making the money. And when I finally reached that goal that I was going to make X amount of money, I was able to dedicate a lot of my time to learning Torah. And the truth is, trust me, my partners weren't very happy when I decided that I'm going to go work part-time. But also realizing not always making everybody at work happy, but making yourself happy or making your family happy, that was a lot more important to me at that time than making my partners happy. And sometimes you can go and chase trying to make everybody happy, and in the end, the only one that's happy is maybe everybody else, maybe, most of the time not, in the end anyway. And not yourself.
Was that difficult for you to make the decision to go ahead and I mean, everybody, you know, makes a certain amount of money, and then you promise yourself you're going to do something, but in the end of the day, you want to go and make more money. And how is it that you stuck to your guns and you decided it was so important that you were willing to give up on that continuation of a dream?
Right.
And watch your partners go much higher, you know, get more and more.
You know, I'm going to tell you one story about how it was a little. When we started the firm, I don't feel bad. I want to turn my back when we started the firm, there's always people that want to bring you down or give you that hope or sell you on an ideal that you'll be able to make a ton of money with this get rich scheme. So when we started the firm, there was a bank. And it was a bank, and he was operating out of Vegas. It wasn't a casino. It was a real bank, had millions and millions of dollars of customer assets. And he wanted to make a deal with us that we'll deposit all our customer funds at his bank, and he'll introduce all his customers to my trading platform. So, oh, this is amazing. This is amazing. And a bunch of my partners went out to Vegas, and he was just whining and dining and doing things that you can't discuss in this room to keep my partners really, really happy. Literally cannot discuss. So they came back, and they were so blinded by the way they were being entertained, wine, dined, and all the other things that we won't discuss. And they wanted to do this deal. And I said, you know what, this guy seems like such a creep. He really does. I mean, and there were other facets of the deal that I didn't like, financial deal, but they were going straight ahead with this deal. And I completely gave 50,000 reasons why they should not go ahead with the deal. And there was fighting for 2 days about doing this deal or not doing this deal. Until I convinced my other religious partner not to do the deal. And I said, look at this guy. Look what he stands for. Based on just the way he was entertaining. And we finally agreed, and my partner was very mad, that we're not going to do the deal. Around 4 months later, this guy ran away with all the customer funds in the bank. The FBI was looking for him, and supposedly there was some mafia money at that bank as well. They found his boat. Now, I don't know if he got away, but they found his boat with his shoes there and a lot of concrete on the boat. So, now, this is something that you can say to yourself. I mean, it sounds like a crazy story. And everyone has some other story in their life. Someone's trying to either rip them off or try to sell them on something or an ideal, or it seems like it's going to be great. But I really firmly believe that because I was religious and because I had a little bit of a moral standing to how I wanted my customers to be treated, how I wanted the business to run, how we wanted certain things to work, that I can't even explain why the business was a success, other than the fact that my wife keeps telling me it's because William just keeps giving that charity. So the truth is, even though I took a tremendous pay cut to go part-time, I still felt that in the end I made more money, because if you don't, and I'm happier, I can make all the, honestly, this business for a while, I mean, we went through our downs. I mean, what helped me make the decision, I don't know if you ever heard of Resco. Resco was one of the biggest bankruptcies. They owned 35% of my firm. This was one of the things that really almost took down the entire firm. That was the second thing that almost took down the entire firm. And literally, this is about when I started, we're going part-time, because Resco, actually a year before that I went part-time, Resco bought out my shares, a portion of my shares, that enabled me to make a certain amount of money that I can go part-time. And I can't tell you, having a firm that was, I don't know, it was written up, oh, fastest growing, biggest, greatest, wonderful company. So going to losing money in literally 3 months, going from the top to the worst, that we were like literally $100,000 within a margin call, that basically the regulators would have come in and said, you do not have enough money to run your business. And literally, I know people that have had heart attacks with things like that happening. So that riding it high and then going so low, and that roller coaster, it can just give somebody a heart attack. I went to yeshiva. I opened up a gemara. I drowned myself in a little bit of learning. I learned a lot of musar. I opened up a lot of books about bitachon. And I really believe, not only did it help me make more money, I don't want to sound like I'm preaching about it. I'm just really telling you what I believe. I feel like it saved my life. Like, I was getting sick over it. I was getting sick that I lost this business, in literally, because one firm declared bankruptcy, and the world felt that if this firm, who owned 35% of our company, went bankrupt, and by the way, that same firm, Refco, we were touting, now that Refco, the biggest future firm in the world, owns FXCM, a portion of, we're so strong, we have this great balance sheet backing us, and everything that we advertised as the reason for our strength ended up being the biggest, biggest con by a guy named Philip Bennett. And I can't tell you the arrogance on this guy, Phil Bennett. He's the one, by the way, that defrauded. He had an IPO, had the biggest IPO of that year. And that guy, Phil Bennett, and also T.H. Lee, by the way, was the one that funded that IPO. I can't tell you the arrogance on these people. I remember T.H. Lee himself was at my office telling us all how great it is that we're having this wonderful IPO. And he went like this out of my boardroom window. He went like this. And we're right near a heliport. All of a sudden I see this big helicopter landing. It says T.H. Lee. I'm like, how do you do that? Like, he goes like this. and a helicopter is like Lance that says T.H. Lee. And you know what? That arrogance that this guy had, T.H. Lee, and this guy Phil Bennett, and he already was worth close to $1 billion without the IPO. But that arrogance allowed him to go public knowing that it was such a blatant fraud that literally, like 3 weeks later, I wanted to short the stock. And I called my broker. I said, something's wrong here. And I called my lawyer, and he said, it would for sure be insider trading. Do not sell that stock. They own 35% of you. I could have made a lot more money and also been with an ankle bracelet. But I really feel that there's so many opportunities that you can really go off and do a Ponzi scheme, the arrogance causing you to do the IPO, bringing down his firm, hurting thousands of people in the process, by the way. Thousands. I mean, I just felt in the end that going and learning and having a certain amount of what I call the discipline, having the faith, and also giving me that emotional support that when you have the down, don't look at it as a down, it's an opportunity. I mean, this market right now, which everyone's like, oh, this is the worst thing that ever happened, and I'm sure a lot of people are hurting. For some people, this is the greatest thing that ever happened. The greatest thing. I mean, there are so many people that are going to become so wealthy from this market. It's unbelievable. It is unbelievable. Our firm went from being the worst after the bankruptcy and being rebuilt to again posting the highest earnings in this year. Because of all the craziness that's going on in the world, we have the highest volatility ever. So all those firms that are their stock is in the toilet, but are traders and they trade like the CME, I mean, there's going to be a time that they're earning so much money just because people are trading like crazy because they're forced to if they want to be in the market. And how many people, every Jew has a piece of real estate that they thought, oh, I should have bought. How many Jews are going to say that again in 5 years from now? Because everything, oh, I could have bought that house in Florida for nothing. But the point is that, I'm sorry? Not Florida?
No.
I'm not a real estate. But all I can say is this. So what keeps it going is it helps me stay positive. It helps me stay prioritized. It helps me stay, although I'm talking about all the great things in my business, but so less arrogant. So I do it for selfish reasons. I'm not even saying I do it for God. I do it for this. I can say that before I became more religious, my marriage was perfect. My kids were perfect. I was perfect. I'm still not perfect, but at least I'm working on it. My wife sees I'm working on it. I think I'm nicer to my wife. I think I make more time for my wife because of it, because I learned to not spend so much time in that office. I literally, when we started that company, was in the office at 2 in the morning, 4 in the morning, because foreign currency trading, if anyone has an excuse other than a doctor that's on call and delivering babies, I promise you I had an excuse to be in the office 24 hours, 6 days a week. Foreign currency is a business that is open 24 hours a day. If anything, it's more volatile and more trading gets done at night than at day.
So when you decided that you were going to give up the time from your work, what made you decide to learn more than spend more time with your family? A lot of people want to give up. They finally make a decision that they made enough and they want to give up time. Don't you find that learning and working takes away from your time together with your family?
Oh, my wife and I had lots of discussions about that. Lots of discussions about that. As a matter of fact, I had a big discussion with, do they all know who your grandfather is?
My grandfather is the science student. I don't know if that means anything.
He's the biggest rabbi in like the entire United States. Honestly, one of the biggest. So I went to his office. I said, he's into learning. He opened the yeshiva. What does he have to say about this? And not only that, he's a principal or of a school, and he's probably, how many years?
At school?
Yeah.
45
years. They said, you know what? I don't know anything about, I have 7 kids, but I know nothing about raising them. So let me ask somebody who's seen kids that are troubled, kids that are, you know, are doing well, And the one thing that your grandfather told me, he said, it's not the quantity of time, it's the quality of time. That was his big line. It's not the quantity of time. You can spend, what makes you think that you're going to spend more time with your kids and your kids will probably turn out worse? Who knows? So I'm not saying don't spend time with your kids. But unless you become a more patient person, you get rid of that anger of yours, that temper of yours, and your ability of, and your desire to just, you know, make billions of dollars, that's not the time that you're going to be spending with your kids. By the way, my kids do come to the office now with me. So that's sometimes with some of the, it helps. But so I realized that. So what helped me learn is because it helped me become a better father. You know, the way I look at it is that when I daven, the truth is, I'm very good with the daven. I was never good with learning growing up, but I was very good with daven. Always very good with going and praying before I started my day. Especially after my father passed away, I spent 4 or 5 years in a hospital with him. He unfortunately passed away from pancreatic cancer when I was 25. And, you know, he was always a very honest person. We were very modern. We never were very into learning or anything like that. But he was into davening. And when I was in Ovo, when I lost him, I was davening I'm the only son. So it was on me that you have to go to shul and you have to say Kaddish for your father. And you can't miss the minyan. And I can't tell you the stress. It wasn't even, I can't say it was pleasant. It was very stressful. Oh my gosh, I'm going to miss the minyan. One time I slept too late. I had to drive to Borough Park because that's the only place that had a minyan. I was living in Staten Island. Once he had a lot of minyan. But it was going out of my mind. And I realized that I made it. The whole year, never missed a minyan or a kaddish. Wow, I was so relieved when it was over. I wasn't relieved. I actually was very sad. It was the first time I actually broke down when my father passed away. It was when I finished saying Kaddish. It was a very odd thing. I came home. I was sitting by, it was dinner Friday night. And my wife looks at me, what's wrong? I just broke down. I felt like I couldn't do anything anymore for him. I thought Kaddish I can do for him. But now what's there? What's left to do? But you know what I did? I really realized? I realized, why does it have to take for someone to die to go to shul? I mean, it's just so ridiculous. Just go to shul. And in answer, my long-winded answer to your question is, I realize, davening, I'm talking to God. But what I want to know what God has to say to me. So I learn. So then he can talk to me, and I can actually figure out what he has to say. So unless you learn, you're not going to know. You might feel, you might think, but there's so many times that I thought a certain way, and it just doesn't enter your mind until you sit there and you learn and you gain a respect for the Rabbanim that actually wrote what they wrote. Because I've gone through law school, I've learned all the financial, I can read all the top stories and books and everything like that, and it all pales in insignificance to what you can just learn. It's unbelievable, these people's minds. And I'll tell you something, I've seen people make millions of dollars in at closings, at certain contracts, at certain deals, on certain trades. And I've never seen the happiness. We have a common friend, Nussin Newman. And this guy, Nussin Newman, I'm going to keep this very brief. He had a brain tumor, and he was one of the top students in a yeshiva in Israel. And he came back here to have brain surgery. So the way he celebrates the fact that the surgery was a success is that he learns throughout the entire shas, which is how many volumes?
24
volumes and
shelves over there.
He learns through all those books, and he knows it, and he makes a siyum. He has to learn 7 pages a day of very complicated stuff in order to actually succeed in finishing it in a year. This year was a little easier because it was a leap year, he told me. So
an extra month.
So I saw his father on his right and his father-in-law on his left, and I never saw so much joy in that room like I did, and he's not making anywhere near probably most of the people in this room. And for a guy to be that happy and feel such satisfaction in what he's doing and hardly be making any money.
He makes $400 a month of cola.
Right. $400 a month of cola. How's he doing that? I got to find out what he's doing. So, but it's unbelievable. So I said, I want that. I just don't see it. It's great having money. I mean, it is. I mean, but it's not the end all be all. It's just not. And I think seeing that it helped me with certain decisions in my life. It even helped me with who I was going to marry. I mean, I wasn't as religious at the time, but and I know this is really going off topic with FXCM, but then again, my wife was the one that made me stick with it. Trust me, the company wasn't going well the first year. I think we made $4,000 each partner the first year. And
just like Colo.
I never thought of it that way. She just learned in Colo. So, and I remember my wife just sitting there and saying, "You gotta stick it out." Just, and I remember I went to Merrill Lynch to get a job, and I was making it all the way up to the top guy. And there's some stuffy guy with a bow tie in some big corner office. And I didn't know what to do. Should I leave FXCM, or should I join Merrill Lynch? And this last guy was going to make the decision on whether I'm going to get this nice job at Merrill Lynch or not. And it was the World Financial Center. And I remember saying, "God, you know, I don't know what to do. If I'm supposed to remain at FXCM, just make it that I don't get this job. I'm going to leave it. Just please make it that I don't get the job." And I remember getting the letter in the mail saying, "You're rejected." I'm like, "Oh, thank God. Thank God." Because imagine FXCM would have been such a success. I went to Merrill Lynch, and then I have my ex-partner calling me, you know, "Oh, we have around $200 million of deposits that we'd like to keep at your firm." I don't know if religion would have helped me from killing myself at that point in time. So, you know, and the reason why I married this woman who helped me stay with this job is I remember dating a different girl who wasn't as religious, but she was very well off. My father wanted me to marry. She goes, "Oh, you're so sad. You don't have to worry about anything." And I said, "You know what? This other girl who I met is so, she's more religious. She's just a happier person. She's a nice girl. She came with some debt too, I'm telling you." But we ended up getting married, and I told my father, "You know what?" I told him she's more religious. So my father said, "Who cares?" My father said, I said, "Well, you know, she's really smart." "Oh, that's terrible. She's really smart. She's always going to tell you what to do. She's going to think she's smarter than you." And he was very sick. He was dying at the time, so I felt really bad that he wasn't. He really didn't get to know her that well. So I said, "Yeah, I don't. I tried everything." I said, "You know, Daddy, she really cooks well." He says, "Oh, that's a reason you should definitely get married." So at least he was happy in the end. But the real reason why I married her is really, she was. I said, "Who do I want raising my kids?" And you're talking about time with the kids, it's making decisions, you know, other than just the time. I said, "This is a girl who just never, never loses herself. She's just my wife's very calm. We're very opposite." And I said, "This is the girl that I want to raise my kids." And we got married. And this is the same girl who was willing to work in a factory. There were literally, she used to come home. She'd show me her box of cereal that she used to take to work for lunch. There were like little mice, like bite marks on her cereal. I mean, it was terrible. But we struggled. And Baruch Hashem, it definitely paid off. So, and you should know, the Ashkach with that story, the marrying my wife, is if I would have married the other girl, I remember what she was making. And I thought, oh, her salary, my salary, wow, we're making a great living. I remember right after I decided to marry my wife, the CFO of the firm that I was working at left, and then they gave me his position. It was a little boutique firm, so I ended up getting this huge raise. Little did I know, the only reason why he left is because he saw the writing on the wall when I didn't. The firm was going to go, and I was going to get canned. But for 8 months until that happened, I was making the exact same salary as if the two of us together. I don't know exactly, but literally that bracket we were in. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's unbelievable. I just
focus through the whole thing. What was your focus that managed to? You think that it helped you and would be helpful to other people to have that focus to sum it up in a sentence.
I think the main focus to me is everyone's got to keep their eyes open. Everyone's got to keep their eyes open and realize sometimes when people make the right decision, they feel like it went bad. They feel like, you know what? How did I gain? Or how did I benefit? You know, I'm not sure that if everyone was in my situation, I'm not going to give myself the credit for thinking of the business, starting the business, or managing the business. But one thing I think I do is I'm very realistic and honest with myself about the different things that happen in my life. And if you keep your eyes open, sometimes you can give a lot of money to tzedakah, or you can do the right thing. And there are different ways that God pays you back. And, you know, you and I were talking. And, you know, my wife came down, like, I think it was two nights ago. And she starts screaming, "Oh, my God, it's a miracle, it's a miracle." I'm like, "You know, what happened? Like, Mashiach just flew through my window or something? It would have been a miracle." She goes, "You don't understand what just happened to our, to your son." I'm like, "What just happened to my son?" So he said, "I gave him a pacifier." I'm like, "Okay." Well, he wasn't taking the pacifier, and then finally he took the pacifier after he just spit out the almond that he was chewing on in his throat. He's 7 months old. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my gosh, you know, sometimes people wonder why certain good things didn't happen. And I sometimes think about, you know what? It's because their eyes just aren't open. The fact that we're all here, the fact that we're all able to even sit here and be here, I mean, I'm sure we can all tell the horror stories, like having my father in the hospital, having this little story, having the different downturns. But I think keeping our eyes open and realizing that there's what to be happy about and who to be thankful for definitely makes you want to do the things that God wants you to do.